That was remarkably successful. Okay, what I'd like to spend the next hour and 20 minutes doing is talking to you about Earth's normal modes, or free oscillations of the Earth. To start with, though, I'm going to make an announcement at the beginning, not at the end, because at the end you're all just going to be thinking of the dining hall. So, if you look at that Google sheet, that Google page where people have put potential project ideas, that's linked from the wiki page. It's no longer on the agenda, as we discovered yesterday. That's linked from the wiki page. Some of you have been showing interest in particular projects. One particular project is so enthusiastic, they've put a couple of papers there for you to think about. As you read through that list and find papers that you really love, find ideas that are going to fit together, put your name there, write some comments. At lunch, talk to some people about some of the projects. Because what we really want is by tomorrow, the projects be much more refined so that over the weekend you have some time to think about them. On Monday, we're going to be full steam ahead. Any questions about that logistical part? Okay, fabulous. Let's try this again. It works, it gets your attention. Do they sound the same? Kind of an obvious one, right? I wouldn't have done it twice if they were going to be identical. I'm going to stop in case I break one of the cider mugs. Why am I doing this? What do you hear? Yeah, you hear different vibrations, you hear different notes, you hear different pitches. Ebru showed us a beautiful little animation of a wave propagating through a coffee cup where possibly the speed of sound in the coffee was the same as the speed of sound in the cup. It was stunning. I have nothing as pretty to show you today. But actually, the coffee cup is a really nice way to think about what we're doing in normal modes as well. It turns out that this cup has some water in. I'm going to be talking a lot. This cup has no water in. Different material properties can tell you what's in those cups without you in the audience being able to see what's in them. You're very trusting. Nobody's asked me to prove it. Promises water in one cup. But this is exactly what we're going to be doing with Earth's free oscillations. One of the ways, aside from the body wave seismology that Sana told you about, that we can look into the Earth are to use the free oscillations of our planet and say, I can't see into the core. It would be amazing if I could see into the core. That would be super useful. I can't see into the core, but I can listen to the Earth and I can say, what's the Earth telling me about the interior properties that we can't see? So that's what we're going to be talking about. I know there are going to be questions, even though this morning there were no questions at all in the first session. No questions about any sort of terminology or any sort of theory. So if you'd like to ask questions, just wave at me. So one of the things that you would want to know if you're not a normal mode seismologist is, what cartoons should I have in my head? And so these may be cartoons. Let's try this another way. Let's try again. Oh. Okay. Let's do this for a moment. There you go. Okay. So in some ways, these are normal modes of the Earth. In fact, in all the ways, these are normal modes of the Earth. We have two different sorts of modes. You're going to see over here a spheroidal mode. You're going to see over here a toroidal mode. And I'm going to tell you that these modes are activated by big earthquakes. Big earthquakes make these things happen to the Earth, with the caveat that these are slightly over-amplified. It turns out that Greenland isn't at risk of being flung off the North Pole. It turns out that we don't have this exciting salsa dancing center of this particular normal mode. Nonetheless, these are mathematically accurate representations of the surface motion of the Earth caused by normal mode oscillations. That didn't take that long at all.
Are these actually activated by all earthquakes, and it's just that for big earthquakes we can see them, or is there some threshold effect?
So these are activated even by things that aren't earthquakes, it turns out. So the way that we systematically describe these, say, big earthquake shakes the Earth, you get these wiggles, the Earth dances like this, you listen. These are also activated by interactions of the ocean and atmosphere with the Earth. So the ocean and atmosphere pounding on the Earth also push energy into these normal mode oscillations. One way to think about is this going to be a usefully big earthquake to really get things going is, well, you could look at the number, the magnitude. Magnitude 7.5 is normally the lowest we look at. But a way to think about making a normal mode is actually if you've got energy propagating away from an earthquake, is that energy still of a reasonable amplitude by the time it gets to the other side of the Earth because you want to set up a standing wave? Normal modes are also standing waves, and I'll talk about that a little later. But if you're trying to think about how big should it be, then knowing that you need a reasonable amount of energy to set up a standing wave and keep that vibration going is another way to think about it in your head. Does that work? Fabulous. Okay, here are my sad, not dancing normal modes. I'm showing you two normal modes here. This normal mode has a period of about 26 minutes. This normal mode has a period of about 22 minutes. This is a spheroidal mode. This is a toroidal mode. I'm going to tell you a bit more about what they mean later. But let's also see what these things come from. Let's see how I would look at them. Because I just said, well, 0S4, terminology later, remember, that has a period of about 26 minutes. Turns out that after a large earthquake, you can take a spectrum, maybe 80 hours, maybe 100 hours, maybe 120 hours. And so another way to think about Lars's question is there going to be any appreciable energy if I'm looking at 100 hours of data? That's quite a long time. You take your spectrum, you clean it up in the way that every scientist in this room has to clean up their data in some way. Maybe you're removing tidal signals, maybe you're removing glitches. You Fourier transform it, and then you publish it in Science. Or you Fourier transform it, you look at it, you look at the spectral peaks, so the particular spikes in frequency, and you say, that sort of vibration that we labeled 0S4 happens at this frequency of about 0.65 millihertz. That's a period of about 26 minutes. So if we want to look at the normal modes and say, what frequency is this oscillation taking place at, the way you would do that is with a Fourier transformed, really long seismogram. And this is one of those. This one was from a paper talking about the Sumatra earthquake in 2004. And we see a few different things on this spectrum. We see at the lowest frequency, there are all these unlabeled peaks. This is noise. You can ignore those. Things we care about are mostly labeled. We see different brightly colored yellow and blue distorted spheres. We're going to see those again in the next couple of slides. We see these really strong spikes. These are the normal mode oscillations coming out in our data. We see sometimes that there's a label. There's not much to be seen. I'll explain that too. We see sometimes that instead of having one spike, we've got two spikes really close together. That's the case here for 0S4. But you also see it really clearly for 0S2. There's not just one spike. There are two spikes in this frequency spectrum. That's going to be covered in the second half of this lecture. So this is a normal mode spectrum. These yellow normal modes are spheroidal ones. They've got periods of about 54 minutes, about 26 minutes, and about 20 minutes. And we've got a helpful label here on this one. If you can't see at the back, it says dr equals 0.05 millimeters. Dr being 0.05 millimeters is the amplitude that this oscillation is taking. Sounds like a very small amount, 0.05 millimeters. It's the thickness of a human hair, single human hair. But this is the whole planet moving. This is not an insubstantial amount of energy you need to make this sort of oscillation happen.
Is this from a stack or a single seismogram?
This is a single seismogram. So this is one, it's going to be from one of the GSN stations. I can't tell you which one. Australia. Thank you, Maureen. So this is from a station in Australia, which I clearly didn't remember. This is just one seismogram cleaned up, Fourier transformed. It's not going to be the ugliest seismogram that there's going to be used for this. You actually can't really use seismograms that are too close to the station. The Sumatra earthquake turns out to be a pain in the neck to model in various ways, none of which are super important for our purposes here. So these oscillations, these are those ones that we just saw. We've got a spheroidal mode. That was the one that had the amplitude of the breadth of a human hair. This is a cartoon explaining the spheroidal mode, this one on the end. It's called 0S0. We're going to explain the labeling in about 8 slides' time. It's also called the breathing mode. What the cartoon is trying to show you is when this mode of oscillation is activated, every part of the surface of the Earth moves outwards slightly, and then it comes inwards, and then it moves outwards, and then it comes inwards. So you can see why that's called a breathing mode. You've all just had a talk, we've been outside in the sunshine, you've had some coffee, the lights are dark in here. So let's all try being a breathing mode for a second. Okay, this is your basic mode, you're going to be in, you're going to come out, and be in, you're going to come out. Some people are brave at the back of the room, they're being a breathing mode. Let's have some more people. I'm not going to move on from this slide until everybody is a breathing mode. Okay. Thank you. And now you can start to get a sense of why it's so amazing with this mode that we had that sort of displacement. Because when you just pretended to be a normal mode, I know, but when you did that, you had to put a lot of energy in. You were moving your arms, you were moving your legs, you were moving your body. The whole surface of the Earth moving outwards by a fraction of a millimeter takes a huge amount of energy. So that's a breathing mode. There's a question near the back.
Yeah, just a really dumb question. You have 0, 2, 3. Why there's no one?
So we have 0, 0, 0, 0, 2, and 0, 3. There are many, many of these modes. 0, 1 is inertially difficult because you can imagine all of the top of the Earth moving one way and all of the bottom of the Earth moving the other way. The same is true for 0, T1. The other reason that I like this picture is because it gets to 0, S2. And if you're in America, this is great. You can call this the football mode. If you learn about normal modes in England, then you see something which looks like it's this shape, and you're like, that's not a football, that's a rugby ball. But 0S2 is actually the lowest frequency of these modes, so the longest period. And you can see that at one time, it's got the top and bottom of the Earth moving outwards and kind of the equator of the Earth moving inwards, so it turns into a rugby ball. And then the rugby ball happens the other way. And I contemplated getting you all to try and dance this normal mode as well, and Sarah's demonstrating at the back of the room. I decided that if I made everybody do this, you'd end up punching your neighbor, and that might not help with the group project. But these are normal modes of the Earth. These are these Earth oscillations. These are the spheroidal normal modes. We're going to focus on those today. But there are these twisting toroidal modes as well. You can see one of those modes, that's 0T0, so you can imagine the top half rotating one way, the bottom half rotating the other way. I do not have the ability to dance like that for you. We also see that we can get more and more complicated patterns. In this cutaway mode here, we see that the surface is moving in one direction and the inner part of the Earth is moving in another direction. This is mode called 1T2. So I'm showing you the simplest of these modes, the simplest things that are already a bit too complicated for somebody like me to try and dance. So these are the cartoons that you could have in your head for these normal modes.
What do you mean by the inner part of the Earth? Is that like the core? Is it crust and mantle?
I didn't define that for you. And in fact, these cartoons are made for purely solid Earth. You can't, so these twisting modes have shearing motion, so we can't actually shear the outer core. So these are for a homogeneous sphere, and they're twisting some central part, which we define by the physical properties of that ball. Okay, so these are our modes. And to think about normal modes, you need to think about spherical harmonics. And so I stole a slide from Max's talk earlier in this week. And Max briefly mentioned spherical harmonics. Did you hear about spherical harmonics last week? Okay. So everybody has heard some of the words for spherical harmonics. They've seen at least these pictures from Max. Spherical harmonics are just patterns on a sphere. And if you want to represent any function on a sphere or any picture on a sphere, you can just add up enough of these patterns. They're a basis function on a sphere. So this is an image from the bottom of a mantle model. This is S40RTS. This mantle model is actually described in terms of spherical harmonics. You go and you download it, you get a bunch of spherical harmonics. And these cartoons would tell you about what different spherical harmonics look like, but I know that some people hate this topic with a fiery passion. Some of you are already thinking, can I get my phone out and look at it through the spherical harmonic chat? So we're going to have a couple of slides just for those people to get you back on board. So spherical harmonics are just a basis function on a sphere. So what's a basis function? How could we think about a really simple cartoon version of that? Well, if I want to move in 2D space, so if I want to move in some sort of 2D Cartesian coordinates like this, I want it to go over there. we could break that movement down into some sort of movement in the y direction and some sort of movement in the x direction. So if you add up your movement in the x direction, your movement in the y direction, you can represent the vector that you wanted. That's all we're really doing with the spherical harmonics. We're just adding up this pattern and that pattern and that pattern. We can make whatever we want. Another case that you could think about is just representing something with a Fourier series, and now we're moving towards something that's a bit more mathematically like a spherical harmonic. So if we want to represent this box car, we can add up a whole bunch of sine terms. This animation does like me, unlike the previous one, and you can see actually a whole bunch of cosine terms being summed. This again is a basis function. We're just adding up a bunch of simple mathematical functions to represent whatever shape we want to talk about. That's what a spherical harmonic really is. And so these are some of the basis functions that we use when we talk about spherical harmonics. They're super important for thinking about normal modes, but if you want to think about planetary magnetic fields, you probably want to think about spherical harmonics. If you want to think about planetary gravitational fields, you probably want to think about spherical harmonics. Max told us that these were often used when people were thinking about very simple ways to estimate convective properties in the mantle. All of these have something in common. We're all talking about round bodies. So the spherical harmonics being functions on a sphere are really the sorts of tools that we need for all those sorts of, let's investigate some physical property of something that is 3D and round. You're seeing even more cartoons. I stole Max's cartoons. These are more cartoons. We're now seeing spherical harmonics of angular order 4. And we're seeing that you can break down the angular order 4 into something which is stripy, so red at the top, blue, nearly red, blue, red. Or you can break things down so you've got some variation with latitude and some variation with longitude. In a perfect Earth, and we're going to come back to this, all of the motions of the Earth described by these would happen at exactly the same frequency. And we're going to try and understand why that might be the case. So, what are Earth's normal modes? They're whole planetary oscillations. I think we're all happy there. I'm just talking about Earth today, and I wrote that we might talk about some planetary mode results at the end of this lecture. I'm going to tell you now that's never going to happen. Okay? We might get there by 1 o'clock, maybe, but it's not going to happen. If you want to talk about planetary modes, come and talk to me at the end. You can think about Earth's normal modes. You can think about the normal modes of Venus or of Mars. People tried looking in the lunar data, and the results are kind of equivocal there. Helioseismologists look at the normal modes of the Sun. They have slightly different labels, but it's the same physics. They're normally excited by an earthquake, but as I already mentioned, you can actually excite these by pumping energy from the atmosphere into the ocean and the ocean into the solid Earth, so that can be another source of energy for your normal modes. Why should you care? You're all sitting listening because you're very polite. Even if you don't know you love normal modes yet, you're paying attention. But you should care because normal modes underpin a lot of what we do. What sorts of data were used to build the preliminary reference Earth model? Normal modes. Somebody had an amazing guess there, the normal modes lecture. I wanted you to say normal modes. Well done. So the sorts of data that went into building PREM were things like, we know the radius of the Earth and the mass of the Earth and the inertial moment of the Earth. There were over 900 normal mode oscillation frequency measurements that went into building PREM. And there were travel times from P waves and S waves and some other core interacting phases as well. So PREM is built using normal modes. We should trust that normal mode data if we want to trust PREM. If we don't believe that normal modes work, then should we even trust our basic Earth models? The picture on Max's slide of the model from S40 RTS, that's a model that was built using normal modes and Rayleigh waves and travel times. That's what the RTS stand for at the end of S40 RTS. I always used to think it was an abbreviation for the first author's name, Ritzema, but it turns out that the R is Rayleigh waves, the T is travel times, and the S is spheroidal normal modes. So they're built using normal modes as well. If you don't trust normal modes, then should you trust these Earth models? They tell us a lot about the gross properties of the Earth. And I mean gross in kind of a scientific sense, not in a, ugh, I don't want to touch that sense. They tell us about the big scale properties of the Earth. Specifically, they can be one of the best sources of information we have about the density and density variations in the Earth. And I think the guy's going to touch on this some point tomorrow. Okay, fabulous. So I've given you some cartoon pictures, and I've told you that you should care, and you're all smiling and nodding, and it's not lunchtime yet. So we're going to have a look at some of these normal modes. And I'm going to introduce some terminology, because nobody ever asks about terminology. And I'm going to introduce some mathematics. But if you get lost during the mathematics, wave at me. We'll go through it again. Or if you get lost during the mathematics, I'm also going to tell you when you can come back, because there's less mathematics. So let's talk about observations of these things. This is a seismogram. It's a distance of 110 degrees. It's a similar distance to some of the seismogram distances you were looking at in Sana's practical. And we see some of the phases we talked about then. We see S-diff. We see PP. We see P. We up here, we see SKKS. We see these Rayleigh waves and these Love waves, and they're much later in the seismogram. But we can also look at a much longer time series. This much longer time series is fairly old. This paper was published as part of a Caltech record in 1954. And this is now a seismogram where we're not measuring in seconds. We're measuring in hours after the origin time. It's recorded by a strain seismometer in Pasadena. It's a Caltech paper. And then it says, helpfully, drafted with a 22-fold reduced recording rate. So they've had to squish a lot of information onto this seismogram. And so we see that multiple hours after things happen, we've got our Rayleigh waves and our Love waves coming in here. They're all labeled. And we have some ultra-long period oscillations that you can kind of see in this seismogram. And so in this paper, which was written by the amazing seismo team of Benioff, Gutenberg, and Richter, thinking most people have heard of at least one of those names, there is a suspicion here that this may be a mode for the 57-minute vibration is one in which the Earth takes on the forms between a prolate and oblate ellipsoid alternately. That was that football mode. That was that mode that Sarah was dancing at the back of the room because I wasn't going to do it at the front of the room. They wonder if maybe they were seeing a normal mode in this really long seismogram. This is an amazing discovery. This is what that mode would look like. So already in 1952 and publishing in 1954, we're saying, hey, these things are real, and they might be big enough to observe. This earthquake recorded in one of the Kamchatka earthquakes was big enough, to answer Lance's question the third time, to pump energy in a way that we could see it in Pasadena. So let's talk about some of the math for this. We're going to talk about a really simple set of normal modes. And we're not going to think about the Earth. We're not even going to think about Planet Zog from the Burnman practical. Planet Zog was way too interesting for us. We're going to think about the normal modes of a homogeneous liquid sphere which doesn't have any gravity in it. We're not going to tell the physicists in the rest of the building about this homogeneous liquid sphere that doesn't have any gravity in it because they might get kind of upset, but we're going to think about its normal modes anyway. It's liquid, so we only have to think about pressures. We don't have to think about any sorts of shearing. And it's going to have a constant density, a constant bulk modulus, and a radius which we've really excitingly labeled R0. We're going to say that there are some small perturbations in the pressure of this sphere. And we could write a really simple equation, which is actually just one of the equations that Sana presented and did some different mathematics with all the way back on Monday last week. And we could remember Hooke's law, which again, we're just writing in terms of pressure instead of terms of acceleration. And there's only pressure, we don't have any shearing. We could plug these two equations together, just like you did Monday last week. And we could say that we can have this relationship between the spatial bits of the changes in pressure and the temporal bits of the changes in pressure. We're not doing the intermediate lines of working here because it's just what you've seen for body waves, because these are the same relationships. They're the same constitutive laws that we're employing. And so we get speeds for these sorts of pressure variations, which look like kappa, which we said is a constant, over rho, square rooted. So we've not done anything new yet. But we also know some stuff about our amazing planet that somehow manages to ignore gravity and somehow has constant properties throughout. We know that at the surface of our amazing planet, the pressure is zero. And so we can try and solve the equation we had on the previous slide, that's that one, by thinking about the changes in pressure. And the way we do that is in spherical polar coordinates. That's the natural language of writing out spherical harmonics. So this is what our spatial derivatives of our changes in pressure are going to look like. And we're going to look for a solution which looks kind of like this. So I want my pressure to be a function of...
Sorry to interrupt. What's theta and what's phi?
It's a good question, Ved. I think maybe you know the answer already, but I'm going to answer it regardless. So we're going to want our spatial variations in our homogeneous sphere. And so we can think about the variations as a function of radius, that's r. We can also think about the variations in terms of phi, and that's our angle around the equator. And we can think about the variations in theta, which is our angle that goes from the North Pole through the equator to the South Pole. Okay? So our theta and phi are the two angles we need to change latitude and longitude, or longitude and latitude that way, and get us around the surface of a sphere. And then we can use radius to get ourselves in and out of the inside of this planet. Does that work for you? Okay. So we want an easy solution, right? We're going to look for a separable solution. We're going to make the maths nice and straightforward. We're going to say that our pressure varies as a function of radius, some function of r of radius. We don't know what that is yet. It varies as some function big theta of the angle little theta. Sorry about that. And some function of the angle phi. And we probably want some sort of temporal variation, and there's going to be some sort of frequency in there. And if you want to solve this sort of equation, you just need our old friends, those spherical harmonics. They're those YLMs that you've seen already. They're just those patterns on a sphere that are useful ways of writing out functions on a sphere. And it turns out that our functions of theta and phi are just those. So we've done a bunch of the work already. And we can write down our spherical harmonics in mathematically useful ways. These slides are going to be online if you care about those mathematically useful ways. We're following the work in the textbook of Aki and Richards here, but I also like Dahlen and Tromp for looking at normal modes. So, there are spherical harmonics, and we found that they're the solutions to the angle-changing bit of our vibrations. And now all we have to do is work out what's going on as a function of radius in our planet. That would be the equation we are left with once we plug in our angular parts and our spherical harmonics. And this equation here has got some L's in it. They're bits of our spherical harmonics. We're going to have to think hard about those in a bit. We would like to have no singularities in our planet. It would be useful if we had no singularities in our planet. If you make me an Earth model that has a singularity in it, I'm going to be slightly sad. I might be very sad depending on what sort of singularity it is. So we'll try and avoid those. And it turns out that you can actually solve this ugly-looking equation really well just with a mathematical function called a Bessel function. This is a Bessel function, this J of L thing here. And all that Bessel function cares about for a particular normal mode is this velocity, which just depends on the physical properties of our body, what radius you're at, so what value the Bessel function should take, and the frequency of your mode. This is the frequency part of our pressure variation. These Bessel functions have really nice properties. They're used in a number of places. You'll see them employed in optics, for example. They're our Bessel functions. So although it feels like I've thrown quite a lot of mathematics at you, there are some important bits of it. There were lots of letters floating around. They'd already asked me about those thetas and phis. But we had some n's popping up in our Bessel functions, and we had those l's. And we could have some m's as well. So let's talk about what those letters are and why we should care. N, you'll sometimes hear that called the overtone number. You'll sometimes hear it called the radial order. You can think of this as the number of zeros along the radius of the motion of a mode. So here are some example cartoons. This is the radial behavior of that breathing mode, 0s0. So we'll think about the radial behavior of that. When we did that breathing mode, everything at the surface moved outwards and inwards, and outwards and inwards. So you can see that this motion for this particular 0s0 mode has lots of motion at the surface and no motion in the middle because everything is moving out from the middle, so the middle itself has to stay stationary. That's 0s0. If we would look at a mode where n was 1, we would see that we'd have some motion at the surface at depth, and this is kind of related to Sarah's question, we'd have motion in the opposite direction, and that depth depends on the properties of our planet. And someplace at this radius in our planet, we don't have any motion outwards or inwards. So this is something with an n of 1. And the same thing is true if n was 2 or 3 or 4. You can see a pattern emerge in these displacement functions. L is the angular order. L was a bit of those spherical harmonics. And you can think of this as the number of zeros across the surface of the sphere, the edge of the Earth. So let's have a cartoon of that as well. It's not going to be a dumb question. Okay. That was mine earlier.
Okay. I'm trying to think of this normal modes as, let's say, vibration in a string or perhaps in an empty vessel. So if I see this diagram, it reminds me of nodes and antinodes. So if I were to consider the second one, the 1s0, why isn't the antinode occurring at the middle? Why is it shifted from the middle?
So it kind of depends what you mean by antinodes and nodes, but let me try an explanation and see if it fits for you. So for this one here, 1s0, it's kind of hard to see in the projector, but there's a zero line down the middle of it. You've got a tick at the top and then a zero line follows it down. You have no motion inwards or outwards at the center of your planet. You have no motion inwards or outwards at this place, maybe two-thirds of the way up this particular planet. It's not moving inwards or outwards at any time. The surface is moving outwards when this point at depth is moving inwards. And vice versa, if the surface was moving outwards, this point at depth would be moving in the opposite direction. So if I'm with your terminology, then this is a node, it never moves. This is a node, it never moves inwards or outwards. The surface here is an antinode. It's moving the most of anything around it. And you've also got an antinode here at some point, which is moving the most of anything around it. So if I was to animate this, you would see this. You would see everything slowly going through zero until you got a function that was exactly the opposite shape, except distance away from my zero line here means movement outwards in my planet or movement inwards in my planet, because we're not in a 1D string. Does that help a bit or not a lot?
I think the question is, the reason it's not in the middle is because the Earth is spherical.
Yeah.
Right. So
it can't move anywhere with these sorts of modes.
A spring, then it would be in the middle.
We can't move the middle of the Earth, but we can definitely move the surface.
When we say it, are we talking about the node? You're asking why is the zero crossing not in the middle of the radius? Yeah. Yeah. And also, like, you have to think about it, it's in spherical geometry, which is what Guy's saying, right?
Yeah, this is going to be the middle of our planet. That's never going to be going anywhere. This is going to be somewhere towards the center of our planet where we've got lots of motion for this particular mode, and this is going to be at the surface of our planet. That's always the easiest thing to move because there's nothing. There's nothing on the other side of it. Okay, so our angular order is going to be thinking about our surface pattern. So we've got two modes here with the same angular order. Sorry, we've got two modes here with different angular orders. We've got 0s2. On the surface, this would be a nodal line. Nothing is changing here. On the surface, this would be a nodal line. Nothing is changing here. If you want to make those two nodal lines, you can think about the top of the Earth moving outwards, this band around the center of the Earth moving inwards, so this is the equator is moving in a bit, and then the bottom of the Earth moving outwards again, and we've just again talked about our football mode. That's 0s2 because we've got two nodal lines on the surface. We had three nodal lines on the surface, we'd be talking about 0s3. And for this mode, you can imagine the top was moving up, this bit of the northern hemisphere was moving down, this bit of the southern hemisphere was moving up, and this bit of the southern hemisphere was moving down. So there are angular orders. And then our azimuthal order is the final thing we could think of, and this tells us how you arrange those nodal lines on the surface of the sphere. So we could arrange our two nodal lines like we just did, in stripes. We could arrange them in a cross like this, so one vertical or just one line of longitude, and one horizontal or just one line of latitude. Or we could have them both our nodal lines being shown like this. They'd both just be lines of constant longitude. So all we're doing with these letters really is saying, where does this mode not have any motion? Okay? Where does this mode, you pump energy in, it's never going to move anywhere on your nodal line. That's what all those letters are. They're nothing super fancy, they're nothing super complicated. So if we take our L as zero and stick in our Bessel functions, we know that our displacement of the function of radius is just going to look like a sine function. I've actually just shown you those pictures. I cheated already. For L is 1, we can throw that into the Bessel function. It looks a bit ugly, but it's actually just a sine and a cosine. It's a function of radius with some inverse radiuses in there. It looks ugly. It's pretty to plot. MATLAB can totally handle that. And you can keep on doing this, and the equations get a bit longer and longer, but MATLAB can still handle them. We know at the surface of our planet we have no stress. I know Sana talked to you about stress and strain in graduate student offices. If you're at the edge of your office, near the door, stress is low. We're going to say it's zero here. And this actually means that these equations, they need to be zero at the surface of our planet. Only certain values of frequency are allowed for our oscillations. These are the frequencies of our normal mode oscillations. So we know for those modes that I just showed you, for our simple, simple planet, the fact you've got a sign here means the only frequencies you're allowed are ones that just look like a number times pi times the velocity in our planet over the radius of our planet. So we know for our really simple planet what the frequencies of oscillation are going to be. Those are for the modes with L equal to 0. You can plug the same thing into our L equals 1 equation. You can satisfy your stress-free boundary condition, and you'd get the solutions as well. So we know what the patterns of vibration look like in our planet because we've solved them using those Bessel functions and those spherical harmonics, and we've used our stress-free boundary condition to say we know what the frequencies have to be, and they just depend on this C, which is related to the kappa over the rho, the bulk modulus and the density. So the vibrations of our really, really super simple, scaring the other physicists fake planet can be mathematically written down really simply. These are what those radial functions look like. We've actually flipped our signals here. These are our pressure variations as a function of radius. We're now in a different axis, and I think I'm going to skip that because I think it's going to confuse the issue. But we have devised the normal modes of our planet. They're clearly simple. Okay, we've ignored gravity. Planets have gravity, it turns out. We've ignored the fact that planets are kind of solid in many places. Our planet is solid at the surface. But we've got the normal modes which capture all the properties. They have the right sorts of spatial distributions. We've got a function of radius, and we've got a spherical harmonic function if we change latitude and longitude. And we know that those frequencies of oscillation, they just have the N and the L dependence. There's a lot of text here, but what it tells you is that those modes together form a complete set of Earth vibrations. Any motion of the Earth, you can write down by adding up enough of these normal mode oscillations. If you add up enough of these normal mode oscillations, keep on doing it, you can represent a P wave, you could represent a love wave, you could represent an SKS wave. You add up enough normal modes, they're a complete basis function. You could describe any motion of the Earth that you wanted. We've not talked about attenuation. Attenuation would be a big deal in this context. If you have no attenuation in the Earth, you have an earthquake, the Earth starts vibrating. You've got no attenuation, so it keeps vibrating. Then you have another earthquake, and the Earth vibrates more. You've got no attenuation, so it keeps on vibrating more. And you can see this is not going to go well for us after a few earthquakes. Okay? So attenuation is going to reduce the amplitude of those oscillations. We've not talked about gravity. And we've also not talked about how the initial pressure perturbations in our fake planet were generated. I don't understand what earthquakes look like in a pressure-determined planet where there's no solid. So let's not think about that too hard. But on Earth, we know what our energy sources should look like. So we can write down any vibration in our planet with these pressure vibrations, and then the displacements are the things whose nodal lines we talked about already. So now we'd like some more realistic modes. We could do that by looking at the Earth and thinking not just about pressure motions, but remembering that we can shear things. We can have vertically shearing waves, we can have horizontally shearing waves. Those are the body waves you talked about last week. And we couldn't have those in our liquid planet. We also couldn't have any of those toroidal twisting modes in our liquid planet because you can't shear a liquid. So if we did this for the Earth, instead of just using one set of spherical harmonics, the ones we already saw, you'd need 3, and they would be vectors, and I'm going to show them to you, but please don't freak out when you see them. they're actually really friendly. They're delightful creatures. They're vectors. That's super useful because our Earth is a 3D planet. But they're just our spherical harmonics with a bit of differentiation thrown in there. So we've already talked about our radially dependent ones, and it turns out that you can have some where you get other sorts of motion. So these are our radially dependent ones, and then we've got two where we've got motion in latitude directions and motion longitude directions. They're the thetas and our phi directions. So we're just making up vector motion, but instead of having pressure changes, we can now shear stuff. And we could write down the displacement of a mode, and it would take up the whole width of a screen. But it's nothing we haven't just done. Okay? This is just what we did before, except now we've got three vector spherical harmonics instead of just one thing. We've got some function of radius that cares about n's and l's, and we've got some spherical harmonic. Another function of radius, and it cares about this spherical harmonic that has motion in our latitude and longitude directions. We've got another function of radius. This spherical harmonic cares about motion in our opposite pair of latitude and longitude directions. And we've got an oscillation. We could do the same for traction. So we've just done displacement. We could do the same for traction. Then we could just throw those back into the elastic tensor we saw a few slides ago, the elastic tensor that Sana talked about. And we could relate the two. And then we could have four more screens of algebra. And then you'd all be asleep. So let's not do that. Let's instead let you believe that that would only take a few screens of algebra, that if you weren't used to working with spherical harmonics, you'd probably have to look in a textbook. You might have to look in two textbooks. But you could all do that with the level of mathematics you have. For some of you, it's going to be easy. For some of you, it's going to be hard. But you would lead to two sorts of normal modes. There would be two sorts of solutions that would pop out of the equations that you could all derive. When you did that, you'd find one sort of normal mode that contained that radial motion and one sort of lateral motion. And you'd find you got another separate sort of solution which had the other sort of lateral motion. The first of those, and my movies are working now, how exciting. The first of the sorts of normal modes that you could all derive would actually have these sorts of motions. It would be a spheroidal mode. It would include motion inwards and outwards and some sorts of shearing motion. And the other sort of mode that you would have found the solution to would just have this twisting SH-like shearing motion. You would have just derived the spheroidal normal modes and the toroidal normal modes. The toroidal normal modes, you don't have any of that in and out of the planet. You are just twisting. The spheroidal modes are where you get countries scarily being flung from the surface of the Earth in these animations. They're where you get the in and out motion as well as some sorts of shearing motion. So we have these two different sorts of normal modes. And once again, we've just got those n's and those l's that we've already defined, so how many nodes you get when you go deeper and how many zeros you get around the surface of the Earth for your n's and your l's. And now you can see why I had an s when I labeled some of those modes, because those were spheroidal modes, and a T for those toroidal or twisting modes. We've done some great normal mode work here. We could now add gravity. Oops, we forgot gravity. We could now add gravity, and we know our planet is basically round, and gravity is the reason for that. We would start with Poisson's equation, so we'd think about gravity. We'd have a gravitational potential. We would do all the math together, happily, but not today. And we will get our normal modes. And these are now not the normal modes of our non-gravitating, homogeneous liquid sphere. These are the normal modes of the Earth. And they're not as beautiful, and they're not as smooth. We are seeing here the radial parts of displacement and the displacements in our S direction. So that's actually giving you some sense of the lateral parts of displacement here. That's why you've got a blue line and a green line. These are plotted for a real Earth, and if I orient you a bit, the surface of the Earth would be up here. The center of the Earth would be down here. And the zero line, so where there is no action, that's here. And already you can see that I must have thrown in a realistic Earth model, because really super exciting, dramatic things happen at a depth around here and a depth around here. Those really exciting, super dramatic things, it turns out, how the behavior of these normal modes change as you go from the solid mantle into the liquid outer core, and how the behavior of those normal mode vibrations and their patterns of displacement change as you go across the inner core boundary. So you can see that on a more realistic Earth, 0S2 has lots of displacement in the mantle and lots of displacement in the outer core, and you can barely see anything going on in the inner core. Turns out there's a tiny bit of sensitivity there, but not enough for you to be able to see on a slide. Whereas when you move all the way over here to this mode labeled 0S8, you can actually see that you've got very little going on in most of the outer core. Really has some real displacement around the core mantle boundary, and also cares about the whole mantle and different directions, so your blue and your green lines of displacement are not the same here. We could keep on changing the modes. I could just sit here and just maybe flick through slides and slides and slides of what these patterns look like. Instead, I'm just going to show you this one here, where now previously we'd got the N being zero all the time, and we were changing that L, so we're changing the number of nodes on the surface. If we keep the number of nodes on the surface the same and just keep on changing the N, we can see these get what I'm going to call much squigglier as a function of radius. Okay? So if we're changing the radial order of our modes, we can see that for this mode, 12S2, we've got lots and lots of squiggles. This mode has some stuff going on in some directions through the core. This mode here next to it, not much going on through the core. This mode here, loads of action going on in the inner core, very little happening in displacements at the surface. Why am I bothering to show you this? It's not just because I love graphs with blue lines and green lines on them. These different modes, which have different frequencies, and we know that the frequencies are going to be a function of that N and that L, they care about different parts of the Earth. To be clear, I'm showing you displacements here, so I'm not showing you how much it cares about a bit of the Earth. I'm showing you kind of some sense of how it's moving. But if you want modes where lots is going on in the inner core, you might want to pick this mode and think about its frequency. If you want modes where lots is going on in the mantle and not so much in the core, you might want to think about this mode. And you could take these displacements and you could use them to mathematically say, where am I sensitive? You could construct sensitivity kernels. And I think Guy's going to talk about those as well tomorrow. Fabulous. So for all of those different modes, we could also think about the equivalent toroidal modes. And I'm really going to skip toroidals for the most part. We could think about the twisting modes, and they'd have their own eigenfunctions. Because we're twisting, we've actually only got one sort of displacement to think about. We're not going up or down. And we could look at how these different mode patterns look. So again, we could think about the football mode, or we could think about the breathing mode, or we could think about the mode where things on the outside are going out while things most of the way into our planet are going in. We could look at all of these different sorts of cartoons. But each of these modes has a characteristic frequency that we can mathematically write down if we know what the Earth looks like. And so if we take our radial mode, sorry, if we take our modes where n is equal to zero, they're our fundamental modes, we would say that the mode 0S2 has a lower frequency, and as we increase our L systematically, they get higher and higher and higher in pitch. And these are modes for the real Earth, these are mode frequencies from Prem. So there are n equals zero modes. And this is what they look like. As you get higher and higher in L, you'll see that the mode energy gets concentrated closer and closer and closer and closer and closer and closer to the surface of the Earth. So that's what happens as you increase up in frequency. Now, these fundamental modes... Of course.
So you didn't put the 0S0 on that nice graph with the frequencies varying?
I didn't. It's going to pop up later in a different color. Sorry, what's your question? Well, I guess that was a statement to start with. I didn't.
It doesn't fall on the line, right?
No, it's not going to fall on the line. It's not going to fall on the line.
That disturbs me.
Zero. 0S0 is one of a special sort of modes. It's a radial mode. Those radial modes don't fall into the normal patterns. They're going to hug the axis of that previous graph. And those radial modes are modes where you don't get any variation. It's got an L equals 0, so you don't get any variation when you move across the surface of the Earth. There are no nodal lines there. They have special properties, and they're going to actually have slightly mathematically simpler formulations, and they're not going to fit onto that trend. And I'm very sorry, it might upset people.
Maybe it'll make you less disturbed if you think about that the radial modes are about changing the volume of the Earth, so they depend on the incompressibility, which is much greater than the shear modulus, so they're going to have a much steeper slope.
I like that explanation. I'm going to keep that one. Okay, so I've showed you those n equals zero modes, those fundamental modes, because these are the easiest way to think about something I mentioned at the very beginning, when I said that you could think about normal modes actually just being standing waves of energy being propagated around the Earth. And so if you were to have an earthquake, a cartoon earthquake, and you were to send some surface waves this way, and send some surface waves that way, and the Earth is 3D, so you're also sending them out into the audience and back outside the screen, and you let these waves propagate around the Earth, you can set up standing waves if you have surface waves of the right frequency. And so one thing that helps some people and bewilders some people is to think about the equivalence of surface waves and normal modes. These modes that we're talking about, these sorts of zero S, a big number modes, you can think of as just standing waves set up by surface waves of the correct frequency that will give you the sorts of vibrations that those modes patterns define. So there is a continuum in understanding of going from normal modes to surface waves. The continuum of understanding really works for those vibrations of the surface. You could theoretically do the same for waves trapped at the core mantle boundary or waves trapped at the inner core boundary. You could talk about the stony modes that get propagated kind of as surface waves along that boundary, and then you set up an interference pattern and you can make those boundary-sensitive vibrations deep in the Earth. But from a seismologist who just does normal modes perspective, surface waves are just what happens when you don't pay attention to your normal modes for long enough. Surface waves are what happens when you haven't yet set up that standing pattern. You're just looking at it in time and seeing the surface wave go past different places. But if there was enough energy and you let that standing wave get set up, you'd really be looking at a normal mode. Okay. So those were the first line of modes.
Can we have an idea about the period of the 0S25 mode?
You know, I can't tell you what the period of that mode is, but I'm going to cheat and I'm going to look at the graph, which is next. So the period of 0S25, well, 25 looks like it's about there-ish. So I'm going to say that it's about 3 millihertz, maybe 300 seconds. So I don't know, but I can cheat with graphs. It's great being a scientist. Okay, so those are the normal modes I showed you before. You could then plot up the next line where instead of having n equals 0, n equaled 1. And then you could keep on plotting up those lines, and I'm not going to click through them one at a time because you'd be bored witless. What you can see, though, is a whole family of these different modes. So those were the fundamentals. These were the first overtone branch with n equals 1. You can keep on plotting branches. There's some really complicated, interesting structure in there. For people who care about this, I could talk to you for hours, possibly days, about what's going on. Not going to. But we could also look at these modes and group some of their behavior together. We would say that these fundamental modes were kind of like Rayleigh waves. If we would look at the modes that plot kind of in this sort of window here, turns out those modes kind of have sensitivities of the sort of an SCS or an SKS type wave. So just like these modes here had sensitivities kind of like those of a surface wave, and which mode you picked would slightly affect your frequency sensitivity. Modes that are over here, they kind of have sensitivities like those SCSs or SKSs. Modes which are kind of in this wedge over here kind of has sensitivities like a PKP, so it cares about the mantle and it cares about the outer core. The modes which plot up here with really small angular orders but fairly big ends, they actually care quite a lot about the mantle, the outer core, and the inner core. And then, to make Lars happy, we also have our radial modes. And these are the motions, again, where you've just got motion at the surface, which is outwards and inwards, and every part of the surface of the Earth is doing the same thing. And these would plot along this line. They'd be super difficult to see, and you can see they're spaced much more strongly as well. And there was another question somewhere.
Are you going back to the previous slide?
Yeah. Yes, I can, it turns out.
Yeah. And for large L, the group velocity seems to be constant. What is the explanation of that? Do you have any explanation of that?
So compared to what you would normally be looking at using surface waves, we're at a pretty small frequency range. So we haven't got to many of the interesting things. I would not try and personally interpret any of the details of the curvature of this. I might let Guy do it, or somebody else who thinks about surface waves do it. Christine probably has strong feelings about this. But I'm not going to speculate further on those from this graph. I don't think it's a fine enough resolution to see. Sorry. Okay, so I'm not speculating about those, and I'm not letting Lars be happy about the radial modes. We could also look at the toroidal modes again. We see the toroidal modes, nothing is going on in the outer core. You can't shear a liquid. We see that as we increase that L number, again, when we march through the toroidal modes, we're more and more sensitive to the surface. We could say that for those toroidal modes, so we increase the N, we're basically seeing things which look like love waves. And we could plot up all the toroidal modes again. The toroidal modes would look like this. You see many fewer complexities. You don't see, for instance, those modes which are trapped at the core mantle boundary because they really don't want to talk to the liquid outer core. The set of toroidal modes is much simpler. They're used much less commonly, and they're much more difficult to measure. And I think that's the last I'll say about the toroidals. So there's our zoo of modes. We've got some radial modes, we've got some spheroidal modes, and we've got some toroidal modes. We've already said that with no attenuation of the Earth, we'd be in big trouble. Our earthquakes would make our Earth oscillate more and more. And so attenuation or anelasticity is something that Maureen talked about last week. Attenuation is harder to measure with modes than the elastic properties of the Earth. So I'm going to leave those aside, except to say that basically the attenuation is just the complex bit of the decay behavior of our oscillations. So we've got into more realistic modes. And if the publication in 1954 by Gutenberg, Richter, and Benioff, or some arrangement of those names, was somewhat speculative, by the time we got a little bit later, we're seeing data from two earthquakes, Chile 1960 and Alaska 1964. We're seeing now that instead of having to eyeball a seismogram that's been drafted at reduced rate and say, I think I can see some wiggles, we can take seismograms, we can Fourier transform them, we can plot them up in cycles per second, because we're kind of old school in our units in 1966, it turns out, and we can see those overtone modes. The peaks are aligned with some predicted frequencies, and we see those frequencies for the spheroidals. We see some of those for the toroidals, but the spheroidals are much easier to pop out. So this is a real observation. We're seeing the log spectrum of strain. We're seeing modes like 020 all the way up to maybe 0S18 at kind of 2.8 cycles per second. So if we were trying to get up to 0S25, I think was asked about, it would be here-ish on that plot. So now we understand some of how these sorts of behaviors can be mathematically thought about. I have about 20 minutes left to talk, so I'd like to tell you about some of the uses of normal modes and some of the complexities that we have blithely skipped over because you let me get away with it. So let's talk about one of the uses of normal modes, which I, as a core seismologist primarily, think is one of the really neatest things that got done. We have an inner core at the center of the Earth. Just told you that the outer core is liquid. I assume last week somebody told you that the inner core was solid. I'm going to assume that's the case. Inner core, lump of iron, outer core, liquid iron. And in this lovely two-page paper in Nature in 1971, Jawanski and Gilbert really put rest to the idea that maybe the inner core wasn't solid. There had been hypotheses put forward that maybe the inner core was just some different sort of liquid. How can you make sure that the inner core is solid? Well, it turns out that what these authors did was to calculate the normal mode frequencies of the Earth with a solid inner core and a liquid in a core. They did it for this list of modes where they were confident that the mode frequencies had been measured well. We've got some of those radial modes, and we've also got some spheroidal modes here. There are some periods of observation. You can see that in a two-page paper in Nature in 1971, you could get away with having seen something seven times and be super confident at that many significant figures. You can measure those periods. You can then predict the periods for your liquid inner core and for your solid inner core, and you can look at the mode misfit. And if you have a liquid inner core, you have a misfit of 1. And if you have a solid inner core, you have a misfit of 0.1. So you can use the simple frequencies of these normal modes of oscillation to say, no, really, the inner core is solid. And depending on which work you like best, it took several decades to see a shear wave being transmitted through the solid inner core. The other way you could be happy something was solid, say, no, I can see shear waves going through it. It really must be solid. But this normal mode argument was made in 1971 and really put rest to any of the biggest concerns about the nature of the inner core. So the normal modes can be really powerful. And I think Sana talked a little bit last week about how we did something that's really no more complicated than this to try and look at the structure of the outer core. And I might be talking about that in the next couple of weeks in a research talk, but if I'm not, come talk to me about how you can still use just simple normal mode frequencies to understand really big chunks of the Earth. So which is your favorite bit of the Earth? Let's try a poll. Who cares most about the inner core? It's just me and Guy then. Who cares most about the outer core? Okay, more people. Who cares about the lower mantle? Oh, everybody loves the lower mantle. Who cares about these scary things near the surface? Okay, that's a bunch of people too. So whichever your favorite bit of the Earth is, there are normal modes which care strongly about seismic velocities, density, and attenuation of that bit of the Earth. Not only that, but there are modes which care about the lateral variation of those properties. So not just what is the property at this depth, but what is the property at this depth under the US versus under China versus under Australia versus under the Southern Ocean. There is a mode which cares about the thing that you care about. Might not care about it in the same way you care, but there is a mode that cares. But in order to understand those lateral variations, we need to add a little bit of complexity. So again, super happy, animations are working. It's nearly lunchtime, so let's keep ourselves awake. If I was to try and be the normal mode on the left, part of me would be doing that. Let's see everybody doing that. You know I'm the only one being recorded here right now. Okay, if we were to be the normal mode on the right, kind of like that. Now let's say you had a bad shoulder. Some sort of heterogeneity has caused something to be a bit different in the Earth. The Earth we've talked about, and the Earth we've been modeling the normal modes for, has the same properties across the Earth at one particular depth. So the frequencies are the same. What we're going to talk about now is the more realistic case where properties vary as a function of latitude and longitude at any given depth in the Earth. And with the kind of, I've got a bad shoulder, I'm changing my frequency example, what I was trying to get across in a slightly hand-wavy way was that if you have these lateral variations, like this bit of the planet has a bad shoulder or a dodgy lowermost mantle or a slightly stiff part of the inner core, you're going to get different frequencies for those sorts of oscillations. They're going to be really similar, because a shoulder is still a shoulder, and a knee is still a knee, and a low mantle is still a low mantle. But they're going to be ever so slightly different. And we've been cheating, because we've been talking about an Earth which is not like that. We've been talking about what we would call a sneery Earth. This does not mean a skeptical or mean Earth. A sneery Earth is spherical, not elliptical. It's non-rotating. That doesn't seem to be true. It's elastic. Remember, attenuation is a big deal. It's isotropic. Even PREM isn't isotropic. PREM has anisotropy in the model. So we've been talking about an Earth which isn't a lot like the Earth. And when you get rid of these approximations, you start to see that a mode like 0S3, this is one of the modes we saw in that spectrum from Sumatra, doesn't have a spike just at one frequency. It has spikes at multiple frequencies, and they're really close together. So we're here, 0.46 millihertz, 0.47 millihertz, 0.48 millihertz. These vibrations are all really close together in frequency terms, but those slightly different azimuthal patterns, the slightly different way that you distribute your nodes on the surface, give you slightly different bits of the Earth that are moving in each case, which give you slightly different frequencies because the Earth is not a sneery Earth. It's elliptical, it's rotating, it's attenuating, and it's anisotropic. And so these sorts of normal mode splitting can be and are used to image variation in the Earth. So the spheroidal normal modes that went, for example, into building S40 RTS, we're actually looking at the splitting of those normal modes to say what is the lateral variation in structure. And many global tomographic models have mode data in them. So when we plotted in the seismology tutorial yesterday, the model of Malik and Ekstrom, that has normal mode splitting in it. That understands some of the lateral variation in the Earth by thinking about how the Earth changes slightly the frequencies of some of these oscillations. I'm going to skip over a few slides here. Otherwise, you're going to hate me for not finishing on time. Okay. So this, again, is the football mode. This is 0S2. And when we look at the spikes in the frequency spectra of 0S2, we see here at the South Pole that there's really just one spike. By the way, you're seeing some synthetics in red and data which is kind of noisy in black. We see that different spikes seem to have different amplitudes at different places on the surface of the Earth. This station is really only seeing one spike because it's really close to the South Pole. It turns out there's only one of those spherical harmonic patterns, the M equals zero pattern, where you can move the South Pole. All of the others have a nodal line at the South Pole. When we get to near the equator, so maybe a station like KMB, we're seeing more of these spikes. And if we look at just the right place on the surface of the Earth, we can see five spikes. So 0S2 can have up to five frequencies very close together, corresponding to the different patterns of vibration. So if you want to see all of these patterns of vibration, you need to look at lots of seismic stations across the Earth so you can see all of these different singlets, and you can take those singlets and make what we call a splitting function. No math for us here. Okay. This is one of those splitting functions.
I have a question.
Go for it.
So these synthetics that you just show, the splitting, does it depend on the location of the earthquake?
There are a couple of different ways to conceptually frame this. And the way that works in my head for this question is to say that where the earthquake is going to depend on which singlets you can put energy into, so which patterns of vibration you can put energy into. And then what you're going to see at your station is which of those patterns of vibration geometry lets you see there. So if you pump lots of energy into all of those singlets with some earthquake, if you're at the South Pole, geometry means you can only ever see one of them. So what goes into the Earth oscillation depends on where the earthquake is and how big it is. And then what you can see depends on which of the singlets you're able to see at that particular place where the station is. So those were all predictions made for one earthquake at a variety of stations there, just for one mode, one particular Earth structure. Does that answer your question, or would you like a different way? Okay. I feel like that maybe wasn't a yes, but it also wasn't a no. So we're going to keep on going. So a splitting function is essentially a way to take all of those pictures from all of those different stations, not just for one earthquake, but for many earthquakes where you've poured energy into all of the different singlets, then looked at them at lots of different stations and say, what does this mode look like from just here? This is a splitting function map. And a way to describe in a cartoon fashion what a splitting function map is how a mode sees Earth structure in a depth integrated sense across the whole depth of the Earth that it particularly cares about. And so this is a splitting function for 0s4, and it says, which bits of the splitting do I see here? How does my mode see this in a depth integrated sense? So it cares about the crust, it cares about the upper mantle, it cares about the lower mantle. We've even got some displacement for this mode in the outer core. It doesn't care what's going on in the inner core, so this isn't my favorite mode. But this mode here, 0s4, has a pattern that we might start to think is a bit familiar. This mode here with these eigenfunctions is kind of blue around the Pacific. And we've colored it in so that the color is the opposite, and in this case red, because I'm trying to be a bit suggestive, the center of the Pacific and under Australia. These splitting functions are all actually off Mike Ritzwaller's website. Lots of people publish these pictures. So this is a mode which cares about the low mantle and also has displacements in the low mantle. Its sensitivity kernel is strong in the low mantle. We could look at other modes. This is 2S7. This is also not my favorite mode. Instead of showing you a displacement here, here I'm showing you sensitivity kernels. So where you see blue far away from the zero line, this mode has strong sensitivity to little changes in VS. Where you see green, it has strong sensitivity to little changes in density. And where you see red, it has, well, not many for this case, but some sensitivity to variations in VP. This particular mode cares a lot about the upper mantle, down through the mantle transition zone, and gets really quite bored by the time it gets to the mid-lower mantle. No real sensitivity to the core mantle boundary, nothing going on in the outer core in terms of sensitivity or in the inner core. So when we look at the splitting function here for this mode, we would keep in mind that it cares about the upper mantle and the transition zone a bit below it. And we would say that this splitting function seems to have blue stuff here under South America and blue stuff kind of under Indonesia, up through the Philippines towards Japan. If we look at another mode where there's lots of sensitivity here in the lower mantle, at the core mantle boundary, we see instead something with a big red blob under the Pacific and a big red blob under Africa. What these splitting functions are doing is depth integrating what they see in the Earth. This mode cares about the lower mantle, and this looks kind of like the large-scale structure of a mode which sees the lower mantle, so it looks kind of like a lower mantle tomography model because it's seeing the same structure that's shown in that tomography model. Whereas for the previous splitting function, it looked kind of like you could have taken a slice through a really long wavelength picture of an upper mantle tomography model because it was kind of seeing that sort of thing. The mathematics is a bit more complicated. The way all this plays out is that you'd take your velocity perturbations, you'd take your sensitivity kernels, and you'd integrate those and find out what your mode could see. But you could then use that data to make a tomographic model. There are some caveats. Modes are amazing, and I said that this was going to be you learning to love normal modes. It might have worked. I've got 10 minutes left. But they're not perfect for everything. If you want to understand the gross scale structure of the Earth, they're really helpful. But they can't see everything. Modes tell you about big structures and big variations. If you want to understand if the crust under here is different to the crust on the beach, modes are not the tool for you. They're going to tell you about big scale structures. And that's because there are some mathematical rules which help us understand what the modes can see. These are just a consequence of geometry. And the rules go like this. Modes can only see certain sorts of structures. If you write your Earth structure in terms of spherical harmonics with an angular order S and an azimuthal order T, only some modes can see that sort of structure written out in spherical harmonics. So, for example, one rule would tell you that if you have an axisymmetric structure, that is a structure that changes only a function of latitude, not as a function of longitude, only one singlet, the M equals zero singlet, can notice that. There's another rule. The next rule says that the angular order of your Earth structure plus twice the angular order of your mode has to be equal to zero if your mode is to see your Earth structure. That's a weird-looking sum. But if you've got 2L plus S having to be equal to 0, that means that S has to be even. And that sounds boring. Why should you care? That means that normal modes can only see even degree Earth structure. If you just look at one mode, you only see even degree Earth structure. So if you've got hemispheres in the inner core, one normal mode will never be able to see that. If you look at one normal mode on Mars, you wouldn't be able to see the crustal dichotomy, because mathematically the normal mode just can't notice that. So when you look at the tomographic models which are built using normal modes, self-coupled normal modes, and we've only been talking about those today, can only see even degree structure. So you can see the Pacific versus African superplumes. Sure, no problem, that's degree 2. But if you wanted to see an odd degree structure, like degree 1 structure, normal modes are not your friend. There are tricks, we've done this, there are ways to make it work, but I'm not going to talk about those today. And finally, we've got some sort of relationship between the angular order that we can see in terms of the Earth versus the angular order of the mode. And the rule for that one is that S is going to have to be between 0 and 2L. And again, that doesn't mean anything in terms of the numbers, but what that tells you is that for a given L, you can only see structure where the angular order gets so big. And the way around that you should all think about that is you can only see long wavelength structure. And if you want to look at shorter wavelength structure, you're going to have to look at a mode with higher and higher and higher angular orders. So a mode with a low angular order, like 0s2, can't tell you about short wavelength variations. It's mathematically just can't see it. By the time it's looked at the Earth, those variations all get averaged out. So the modes are really useful, but they're not perfect. But they're really useful. Finally, there are ways to break these rules. Normal mode coupling actually says Earth is not sneery. It's not elastic, it's rotating, it's attenuating, it's anisotropic. And that means that the basis functions that we use, those radial properties and those spherical harmonics, aren't quite perfect basis functions. And so you can actually take energy from one mode and put it into another mode, or you could say that the basis functions of my modes aren't quite right, my frequencies aren't quite right, and that can lead to mode coupling or interactions between modes. Those interactions between modes can be caused by rotation, they could be caused by ellipticity, they could be caused by 3D Earth structure. I'm showing you here a picture of Guy's from a few years ago, where Guy actually tells us about the coupling between two next-door normal modes due to ellipticity, rotation, and attenuation, or where there's no coupling. You're not going to get a huge amount from these pictures. The paper is actually a really neat paper. More people should read it. But to suffice it to say that if there was no coupling, one of your modes would have frequencies like this and frequencies like this and decay rates that are quite different. And when there is mode coupling, the mode frequencies change and the mode decay rates change. The same thing is true when you look at 3D Earth structure. And more people now are thinking a little bit about the interactions between some of those modes. I could show you some examples, but what I'd like to do instead is take maybe 5 minutes of questions. If you want to see examples, find me at lunch, find me this afternoon, find me next week, find me the week after. Because whatever the project that you want to do at this side, there's a good chance that normal modes can help in some way or other. So I'll take some questions.
I think you really briefly mentioned this, and I would assume that the LLSVP would cause some pretty strong coupling or splitting in certain normal modes. What have we learned about their density, and how confident can we be in it from those?
So, there are a few things. You give me an excuse to show a slide from a few slides along. this slide, maybe? So this is actually, I think, something Guy's going to spend a whole chunk of time talking about tomorrow. So mostly I'm punting the question to him. But briefly, one of the things you can do is actually look at some of these interacting modes where one mode really only cares about the core mantle boundary. And so if you would look at the sensitivity kernels of some of these modes, they really only care about the D double prime and core mantle boundary. And so if you would look at those modes, they have lots of really rich information about what's going on there. And the paper that this is from, and I'll make sure this slide is in the list, actually starts to make some inferences about density in the lower mantle. The results of the density story in the lower mantle are controversial, and therefore I'm making that guy's problem. You're welcome. But there's a whole extra lecture for that, realistically.
So when you talk about spilling function, the sensitivity is based on your 1D model. What do you expect if for the sensitivity based on the 3D structures?
That's a really good, really important question. So when we look at sensitivity kernels, we tend to assume that if we perturb our Earth a little bit, the sensitivity kernel is still valid. Okay? That assumption works most of the time. There are some times when it doesn't work for particularly awkward normal modes. One of the things that you learn when you work with normal modes is which modes are going to cause you trouble in various sorts of ways, and there are some modes that are particularly difficult like that, where if you change the Earth structure, what doesn't feel like too much, you can actually change where a normal mode is sensitive. There are some pairs of normal modes, for example, 10S2 and 11S2, where if you change the inner core a bit, you can actually change their sensitivity kernels dramatically. So there are various different choices you can make there. One is that you should, as a normal mode seismologist, have a sense of which modes these are. There's another pair that's, I want to say 10S6 and 11S6, and a bunch of the time people aren't even totally sure who measured which, because the sensitivities can change and the mode character can change. One thing that some people do is to exclude those awkward modes, but you can also extract a lot of rich information from those modes, and you can treat them in that non-linearized sense. So instead of assuming your sensitivity kernel doesn't change, if you change your model, recompute your sensitivity kernel. That's done normally in a 1D sense, and then say, what does my sensitivity kernel look now? Should I be worried? That's something we worried a lot about when we were working on the outer core with normal modes, that when we were changing our Earth, we were changing it so much that our sensitivity kernel changed. So we chose not to use a sensitivity kernel approach. Other people make different but valid choices, but it is a concern, and it's something that people are careful about and talk about a lot in private with just normal mode seismologists.
Is there other way to excite the normal mode other than earthquake? I was sort of thinking about like planets, I mean moons like Europa that constantly undergoing sort of deformations and stuff. Is there like a way to excite the normal modes in those settings and then use to study the interior and stuff?
A normal mode is just a natural frequency of oscillation of a body. So if you can pump energy in at the right frequency, you can keep it vibrating. I mean, one of the ways that the atmosphere and oceans contribute to this question is to pump energy in from those constant properties. That mostly goes into the fundamental normal modes. You can pump energy in if you get the tidal vibration set up right. I have no sense for how much of an effect that has, how strong an effect that has. My guess is if you set up the tidal resonances wrong, you might be able to blow a moon up. But that's probably best left for Darth Vader and not for me. Lars, is it going to be about the radial modes?
No. It's about the relative amplitude between the T and the S. Two different graphs. The one from Sumatra you showed, the T amplitudes are much less than the S amplitudes. And then another set of data you showed, Alaska versus Chile.
Yes.
The amplitudes of T and S were different for the two earthquakes.
Yes. So I completely skipped over something super important there. You'll remember back from last week when Sana talked about the first lecture in seismology that we look at radial component seismograms or transverse component seismograms or vertical component seismograms. And people who did the practical yesterday, if you wanted to see the right sort of thing, you had to plot the right component. So if you were looking for PK little IKP or PKP, you really wanted a vertical component plotted. Turns out that what you were seeing for Sumatra, that was the vertical component, so the Z component plotted. If you want to see the toroidal ones, you need to be plotting a horizontal component. The instrument from the pair of old earthquakes was a strain seismometer of some sort. And my understanding is that integrates, the way the strain is recorded actually integrates more than one motion. It's not just a pure vertical component. So if you want to see toroidal twisting modes, just like if you want to see SH waves, you need to be looking at one of those horizontal components. That was a really good question because I completely skipped over that. Guy, you have thoughts and feelings.
Well, I could just be mischievous and point out on your first slide that you actually showed which is a vertical component recording, there are toroidal modes on it.
Yes, and that's because our Earth is a real pain in the neck, and it's not a snary Earth, and you can get coupling, and that's what your paper was actually about, was that you can get coupling between spheroidal and toroidal modes, and one thing you can actually do if you hunt hard enough is to see toroidal modes where they shouldn't be on vertical component seismograms. And the last slide, which I was never going to get to, is actually a picture of one of those places where you can see toroidal modes on vertical component seismograms, and I'll leave that in the slides on the wiki in case anyone wants to look. But Guy is completely right. Okay, last question, and then I think it may be lunchtime.
Okay, thanks. When you talk about like four couple modes or single lid, I'm wondering if you look at relative higher frequency mode, say for example 10 millihertz, then you have a lot of branch passing through a short frequency window, and the error is high, so you will see a lot of frequencies. How do you distinguish those four coupled modes or single lid?
So you're completely right that those branch plots were much, much busier when you got to higher frequencies. Sometimes you have to look at all the modes at once and measure them together. Sometimes, though, if you have modes which decay quickly and modes which decay slowly, you can wait until after the quickly decaying modes have decayed, and then maybe look at your seismogram, take it from 50 hours to 100 hours. The quickly decaying modes will have decayed because they're quickly decaying, and you can look at the more slowly decaying modes in that sort of time window. Sometimes you don't have that chance, and you just can't see that mode by itself ever. The Earth is difficult. But we get to go for lunch. Please. Junior participants, please think about those research groups. Start adding things to the Google document. Talk to each other at lunch. Talk to senior participants about lunch. We know you're going to set up really good research groups, and we want to keep that going. Thank you, everyone.